welcome to The Reading Room, the Diagnostic Imaging Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Whitney Palmer. Today, I am joined by Dr. Michael Gottway to discuss the use of CT scans in pinpointing the signature signs of EVALI, electronic cigarette or vaping product use associated lung injury, and the findings that appear in most affected patients. Dr. Gottway, who has researched and published on EVALI extensively, is a cardiopulmonary radiologist with the Mayo Clinic in Arizona.
Well, from a big picture perspective then, why did you continue to work toward looking at the presentation of EVALI? You know, why is it so important to look for these patterns?
Well, probably the major reason is it was an emerging cause of new abnormalities or a new pattern of abnormalities that radiologists were becoming increasingly likely to encounter. I believe that e-cigarettes and similar products, electronic nicotine delivery devices, were introduced in the U.S. around 2007, and there were a few sporadic cases of pulmonary injury resulting from the products, the use of those products. Between 2007 and maybe around 2014 to 2016, very minor reports, not a high prevalence of disease, even though it was probably building in the background. Then around 2019, I believe it was in August 1st, the CDC actually began reporting a cluster of cases. And there were some reports from, I believe, the Midwest just prior to that, month prior to that. And so now it's becoming a little bit bigger of an issue, where it's more likely that radiologists may actually encounter this particular problem. And it causes, I wouldn't say a unique, but a somewhat peculiar pattern on imaging on occasion in younger patients, which is something we don't see quite as commonly. And radiologists need to be aware of it because it may be that the patients who are presenting with these particular disorders are not that terribly forthcoming because they might have a sense somehow or another that they're causing their illness. And because many people probably weren't that aware of e-cigarettes and electronic devices like that causing pulmonary injury, the clinicians might not have thought to ask about it. And so they'd have these abnormalities in imaging, and sometimes these patients would be quite sick. And the standard workup is going to go down the lines of ruling out infection, and that's going to turn up negative in these particular cases most of the time, but they'll still have significant respiratory involvement in a lot of patients, imaging abnormalities that are unexplained. And then the workup may turn towards non-infectious inflammatory lesions, and some of those cases can actually lead to invasive procedures. And that's where our study came in, because my idea for what we were doing here is co-conceived with one of my colleagues, who's the first author on the paper, was because our institution, Mayo Clinic Arizona, is a big referral center for pathology. We have some world expert pathologists here that get material from all over the country, in fact, all over the world. We have a fairly close relationship with them, so a lot of times they'll get imaging as well as the pathology and clinical notes, and they were starting to see this a pattern of injury that was kind of peculiar in these patients using e-cigarettes, in which case they excluded infection, they excluded all kinds of non-infectious inflammatory lesions, and they were left with this peculiar pattern in those younger patients with no other explanation. And they actually reported their data, I believe it was, I want to say November. It was Yasmin Butch, is her name, as a first author in New England Journal, the pulmonologist and pathologist at our institution. So because we're a referral center, we had a pretty ready-made cohort of patients with this disease who were reasonably well-proven. Prior to that particular report with a fair amount of histopathology, the diagnosis of electronic nicotine delivery device injury or vape-related injury, sometimes referred to as EVALI for short, was a clinical diagnosis. So you'd have to look at the patient, interview them, and find that they'd used a nicotine product within the last 90 days, that they had respiratory symptoms associated with some chest radiographic or CT imaging or chest imaging abnormalities, and infection was excluded in as much as could be for a, quote, confirmed case by the CDC criteria. Right. And a probable case was infections possible, and there's ways for assessing for that, you know, respiratory viral panel, perhaps a few other laboratory tests for bacterial infections and whatnot. And probable cases, patients could have infection, but the clinical team would have the judgment that there was more going on than just infection. So the whole criteria was rather subjective and clinically based only. Now we actually had histopathologic proof of the absence of a number of other competing causes with the kind of peculiar pattern on pathology. So it was our chance to actually add to the literature, say, when we see this on imaging, maybe you could avoid getting pathology in these particular cases. Go ask the patient if they're using electronic devices, see if they meet the criteria per the CDC, exclude infection, and if we see a certain pattern in combination, you could avoid getting tissue. Because sometimes getting tissue can be associated with pretty serious complications. So that was kind of the long-winded genesis of how this project came about.
Well, I appreciate you walking me through that. And before we kind of get into the details of the study itself and then looking at the patterns that kind of started to emerge, when you talk about, I guess, the number of cases kind of starting to increase over the past few years, how much more prevalent are these cases of patients who might have these types of injuries becoming? You know, are we seeing just kind of an uptick, or are we, I guess, starting to just pay attention to it a little bit more?
It was slowly percolating in the background between the time of introduction in 2007 till around 2019. And it may be that there were more unrecognized cases prior to 2019. But really, 2019 was a bellwether moment where it was getting a lot of attention across the nation. And I had to look up, let me see if I have the exact number, because I don't think the CDC now is actually tracking these cases, but it was on February 18th was on our paper, the last time I looked at the CDC website, they had 2,807 patients who were hospitalized with a diagnosis of E-Valley.
Oh, wow.
And that was in 50 states, you know, 50 states, and District of Columbia and Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Islands. And at that point, 68 patients had died in 29 of these states. And the District of Columbia. So, and it was, as you watch the publications coming up before our paper came out, people would be doing the same thing, quoting the CDC website, because the CDC had a specific website recognizing that there was something going on across the country, and you would see these numbers just continually rising. And then it more or less plateaued shortly after, while our papers were under consideration. The people reviewing the paper noticed the same thing. I don't know who the reviewers were. It's a blinded study, but one of them noticed and made a comment, he or she, that they weren't seeing many cases. Mm-hmm. And our pathologist had noted the same thing. The pathologist or co-authors on my study, like, we're not seeing this now. So one of two things, probably both happened, is there was increasing recognition of the problem, and maybe there were adjustments in people's behavior with a little bit of education. That may be part of it. And the other thing is we're getting a little bit better at recognizing it. And perhaps there was less need for a tissue diagnosis. That's only part of it, though, because I'm not seeing nearly as much on imaging now for cases that I think are actually suspected E-Valley that seem to have dropped off quite a bit.
Do you have
The other thing is COVID has overrun it as well, too. That's part of the issue. It's in the background now with COVID.
Sure, and that was going to be part of my question, if there was some type of, you know, COVID influence here, or if there's maybe another hypothesis that you might have about why you're seeing this drop-off.
I think the major thing is increasing recognition on the part of clinicians, probably some education on the part of patients. There has been some legislative efforts to restrict these devices, so Tobacco 21 has raised the legal age for use of tobacco products, but there are ways of getting around that with electronic devices. Plus, there are certain things that were omitted in the various bans on electronic devices, particularly I think the menthol-containing compounds were excluded. A lot of the flavored ones were excluded, and those were actually the ones that were increasing in popularity among young patients, you know, adolescents and whatnot.
Right.
So some of the ban may have actually had a positive effect. I think most authors that I've seen publish on this topic would say the ban did not go anywhere near far enough, but it might have helped. So increasing recognition, some regulatory effects, probably some patient education, and then the fact that our attention has been completely diverted to COVID, because it wasn't very long after the E-Valley epidemic was recognized and was getting a lot of attention that COVID started to blow up. And once that happened, it was obviously a worldwide pandemic was occurring, and E-Valley went quickly into the background. I have seen a couple of publications since, however, that E-Valley has made a little bit of a resurgence. I have not seen many cases recently, but I've seen some publications suggesting that patients some patients have COVID are also developing E-Valley as well, and with at least one author speculating it, maybe it's the shelter-in-place orders at home that people are just getting bored and that sort of thing. So they're kind of turning back to various ways of entertaining, which is a little bump in the use of electronic devices again.
Gotcha. Well, yeah, I certainly do remember your first publication back in February. I remember seeing that. And then, you know, as you said, everybody kind of got inundated with COVID and things kind of went in a different direction. But, you know, to turn to your study now, the one that has just been published today, kind of walk me through, I guess, how it was designed and conducted. You know, who did you include? What did you examine? Just kind of an overall framework of how you put this work together.
The genesis and the core of the study was based on the 17 patients who had histopathologic proof of E-Valley with the exclusion of other diagnoses by my pathology colleagues. It was published in New England Journal in late 2019. That's Yasmin Butt and colleagues. Also some pulmonologists on that paper as well. So when we saw that published, we thought, well, we have some case material here. Plus, at the same time, I was seeing a few clinical cases that came up right at the same time for our own in-house cases. So I thought we had a cohort here of reasonably well-proven cases that we could actually describe both the imaging features for, not just the what the pictures look like, but why the pictures look the way they do based on the histopathology that we're seeing. At that point, there were very few publications out there. Henry and colleagues from UCSF had published in both in the New England Journal and AJR some cases. And during the course of our study, I saw Clearman, I think he's at San Diego now, had published a nice review in Radiology detailing his experience with some co-authors around the country. But all the papers to that point had had little background histopathologic proof. So there are cases that met CDC criteria for being confirmed cases, but there's always still that nagging doubt as what else could this be? Could this have been an infection that we missed? Could this have been a transient acute lung injury from something else? Was this actually hypersensitivity pneumonitis? And they came and went, and the patient was also using e-cigarettes, and there's a little bit of a confounder. So I thought this was an opportunity to say, with pathologic proof in hand, we've excluded everything else in as much as one can. Here's what that disease, E-Valley, looks like. So we got our patients together. I had all 17 of Yasmin's patients from the New England Journal publication, and by that time we'd accrued other confirmed cases up to a total of 25. So we can actually combine histopathologic proof, and the vast majority had actual surgical lung biopsies. There were a few that were transbronchial biopsy. We had one that was bronchoscopy alone to exclude everything else. The bronchoscopy exclusion is a little less stringent, at least at some degree of tissue sampling, because there are some things you can diagnose that way. But the real strength of the article was having histopathologic proof, actual surgical lung biopsies, in most cases a few cryobiopsies, which are big sources of tissue, with expert pathologic review. And then we went back and re-looked at the CT scans. And what we did was, since we had histopathologic proof, we thought we'd try and plug the CT reviews into the potential patterns that were already described by Travis Henry and colleagues from UCSF. That way there'd be a framework for radiologists to more or less understand what the typical pattern may be, why it looks the way it does, and what some variant patterns may look like. So that was kind of the genesis of it. I'd say the vast majority of our cases were from around the country. They didn't occur at Mayo Clinic. They were from all over the country, ranging from California to the East Coast, really everywhere. So it was kind of a nice distribution that way, with the strength of histopathology in the background as opposed to just a presumptive diagnosis based on the CDC criteria, which is entirely clinical. And that is by necessity the way you have to do it when these disorders are emerging, because it's hard to get tissue and establish tissue diagnoses. But it's intrinsically weak in terms of making a diagnosis, because there could be competing causes of lung injury that are very difficult to exclude without actually having the tissue in your hand. So that's kind of the genesis of how the radiology part of this study occurred. It was kind of led initially by our pathologist having a referral of biopsy-proven cases from elsewhere.
All right. Well, it definitely sounds like you had quite a representative sample coming from all the corners of the country. So given that, and looking at these images, you know, what did you find? What patterns began to emerge when you started looking at these CT scans?
The major pattern, and we're focusing on CT here because we did use radiographs to some extent, but the radiographs are ultimately very, very nonspecific and can't be characterized as effectively a CT. The major pattern was what we refer to as acute lung injury, so multifocal areas of opacity, which is usually ground glass opacity, sometimes areas of consolidation, and the relative proportion can vary somewhat. Often, but not invariably, with subpleural sparing. So the ground glass opacity gets out near the chest wall and then somewhat peculiarly will spare the subclinical surfaces of the lung, and that's something that others have described as well. That was a major pattern, and in most patients, that pattern would tend to, if the patient stopped using the device, often they would get steroids and antibiotics presumptively before people know what the diagnosis was. That pattern may persist and then go away, often fairly rapidly. Sometimes in some patients with a little bit more prolonged tail before the imaging abnormalities resolved. That was a majority of our patients. And on histopathology, those patients also had what a pathologist would call acute lung injury. So there's various amounts of inflammatory cellular infiltrates within the interstitium and the air spaces. Sometimes there's some air space fibrin. And somewhat peculiarly, it could be pathology would be distributed right around the bronchovascular bundle, so a so-called bronchiolocentric distribution. And that was something that we could occasionally see as well, because we'd see little areas of consolidation that were very closely associated with the airways on CT scan, and that suggested the possibility of superimposed organizing pneumonia. So we'd see areas of ground glass opacity and consolidation. That consolidation would often be sometimes out to the towards the periphery of the lung and wrapped around the bronchi. And that pattern is not absolutely specific for EVALI. There's actually a lot of other things that can do it. In fact, COVID can look very, very similar. Now, we didn't know at the time because there hadn't been a case yet in Arizona when our papers were coming out, but it can look fairly similar. So that was the most common pattern. We had pretty good concordance with when a radiologist would look at that pattern and say it's acute lung injury. The pathologist to say, yeah, we see acute lung injury as well. Both of those descriptions are very nonspecific. They're not diagnoses in and of themselves. There's a lot of things that can cause an acute lung injury pattern in the CT, and there's a lot of things that can cause a basic acute lung injury pattern on histopathology. It gets a little bit more specific on histopathology when a pathologist would comment that the imaging abdomen or the pathology findings are very closely associated with the bronchus, and they see foamy macrophages as well, and that was something that Yasmin Butt and colleagues reported in their New England Journal article, that was actually not specific, but a suggestive finding that maybe this is a vape-associated injury. So that was number one. Sometimes in patients, we would see some really sick patients would have, rather than having ground glass opacity and a little bit of consolidation, they would have a lot of consolidation. So the ratio would be somewhat reversed. And that was what we'd call more of a diffuse alveolar damage type pattern. And I only use that term, unlike some other authors, when we had histopathologic proof of diffuse alveolar damage on pathology. And the sine qua non there is the presence of hyaline membranes on pathology. That's what defines more or less diffuse alveolar damage. When you have that, usually you can have a much rockier clinical course. Those patients are sicker. They're often presenting with hypoxemic respiratory failure. They often require mechanical ventilation, and in the few patients in our cohort that actually died, that's the histopathology that was present on those patients on biopsy. So those are some pretty sick patients, and you can think of it as those are patients that have acute ARDS or acute respiratory distress syndrome as a result of vaping. And that's less common, although you will hear other authors will say diffuse alveolar damage in their description of scan patterns. I think Kligerman and both Kligerman as well as Henry use that term, and it's not incorrect. They're just referring to multifocal bilateral, relatively nonspecific CT opacities. So there is a little confusion in the literature when we say acute lung injury. That's really pretty close to what Kligerman and Henry are calling diffuse alveolar damage. I just segregate the two because, number one, we had histopathologic proof, so we knew which of our patients actually had only acute lung injury without hyaline membranes and which ones actually had diffuse alveolar damage with hyaline membranes. And we also had a little bit of clinical follow-up. We can say, yes, indeed, the ones with diffuse alveolar damage generally have worse-looking CT scans, more abnormalities, and those are the ones, if somebody's going to die of this, that's what they're going to die with or of. All right. Those are kind of the major two patterns. And the background pattern that you'll also hear, too, that can be a little bit confusing, I think, when you read the literature, is organizing pneumonia. Because organizing pneumonia can be a diagnosis in and of itself in some circumstances. But what we would see and what we tried to make clear in the paper was that often the acute lung injury pattern will have areas of organization ongoing. So what you'll see is initially ground glass opacity, maybe a little consolidation. And then over time, even over just a few days, you'll see that consolidation contract somewhat. It'll wrap around bronchi. It'll begin to dilate them a little bit. You'll start to see a little bit of distortion on the CT scan. as you get a little bit more fibrosis laid down with that organization. And that's what the pathologist would see as well. So when you get the biopsy a little farther out from their presentation, they'll see areas of organized pneumonia or acute lung injury with organization as well. So you'll see organized pneumonia reported quite a bit in patients with E-Valley. It's often not a diagnosis in and of itself, because when you get pathology on these patients, they do have organized pneumonia, but they have other things going on as well. Only a minority of our patients had organized pneumonia as the only histopathologic finding or the dominant histopathologic finding on surgical biopsy. Most of the time that organization was prominent, but it was in the background of another more prevalent pattern, either diffuse alveolar damage or most commonly acute lung injury.
All right.
So those were kind of the main patterns, and it correlates with what's in the literature. But, you know, part of our paper was trying to sort out these various terms. So radiologists should not actually say, when you're looking at the scan, you say, oh, it's organized pneumonia, therefore it must be vape or E-Valley. It could be, and you should expect to see areas of organization. But what you really should expect to see is an acute lung injury pattern as the dominant finding, maybe with areas of organization as well as the expected finding, and a pure organized pneumonia with peripheral or, frankly, subpleural touching the chest wall consolidation as a dominant finding. That's actually not that common. We did have a couple of cases, but it was by far the minority. And like other authors, we found a couple of other odd patterns. There's a rare pattern, acute eosinophilic pneumonia, which on imaging looks a lot like increased pressure edema or hydrostatic pulmonary edema, water in the lung. You see pleural effusions and septal thickening, but these patients are not in heart failure. Their heart size is generally normal. These are younger patients without known cardiac disease for the most part, so it's a little easier to spot this one in the vape population than acute eosinophilic pneumonia occurring, say, in an older patient, because maybe the older patient's got a bit of a dilated heart. It's going to get called pulmonary edema, and it looks like cardiac disease. These younger patients come in, normal heart size, septal thickening, it looks like water in the lung, and you have pleural effusions. That's a little bit more peculiar pattern that was, again, uncommon, and we can see that with smoking-related diseases as well. And we saw a few cases like that with vape, and when they were biopsied, there were eosinophils all over the lung, and they respond pretty well to steroid therapy once that gets recognized. Vape is not the only cause of an acute eosinophilic pneumonia pattern on CT. It's often related to smoking, but it's kind of added to the list in the minority of cases. And then other weird things as well. We saw a couple of odd patterns that looked a lot like infection, some cysts and whatnot in some patients, and I think we might have shown some of those images in the paper. A lot of things happen when these patients get very sick and they go into hypoxemic respiratory failure and they're on the ventilator. Then you'll start to see all kinds of complications. You'll see pneumothorax, you'll see pneumomediastinum, you'll see various cystic changes in the lung as a result of the mechanical, or at least associated with mechanical ventilation, all kinds of obscure patterns, which incidentally I've seen in the COVID epidemic as well in a few patients. It's interesting how the two parallel each other. There's a certain look in a lot of patients, but there's some patients that are going to have some very odd type presentations or courses, and often the latter is the very sick patient with prolonged mechanical ventilation.
Right. Well, given that you saw these various types of patterns emerge and some are more common than others, was there anything else that you could see on the imaging that may have given you an indication or at least a point in a direction of why some patients end up with one pattern versus another?
there is really nothing that will help you in that regard. It is very peculiar, and I've discussed this with pathologists as well, as to why one person would have the typical acute lung injury pattern. Another person could have, and this is actually the second most common pattern we saw, was a hypersensitivity-like pattern, a pattern that looks very much like non-fibrotic hypersensitivity pneumonitis on imaging. In fact, it can be almost indistinguishable. Kligerman's recognized that as well. Several other people, I think from Boston Children's, that reported on the pediatric manifestations of this disorder have reported that as well. So it's something others are seeing. And there is no reason on the imaging where you can look at it and say, this person got an acute lung injury because of this finding, and this person got an HP look for some other reason. It gets down to the genetics. Somewhere, somehow, somebody has a certain genome that when they get exposed to a certain noxious product is going to create a particular pattern. And in most people, that setup is going to result in an acute lung injury type pattern when it's an exposure to a vape type illness or to a vape type product. In some people, it's going to be more like a hypersensitivity response. And in a small minority of patients, it's going to be an acute eosinophilic pneumonia or pure organizing pneumonia response. And there's no rhyme or reason why, at least from the imaging. Maybe someday somebody will come along and say, it's this compound. There's a lot of different compounds, many of which we don't even know that are in these vape products. A lot of them are illicit, so who knows what's in these things. But maybe, and I'm just making this up here, it's a combination of X, Y, and Z plus THC in a patient who's, you know, a certain age or maybe a certain race or a certain background that has a particular genome that gets exposed that will react in this particular fashion. But there's just no way for us to predict that clinically. There's no way for us to predict that on imaging. You just have to be aware that these various patterns occur with a certain prevalence, acute lung injury, number one, number two, hypersensitivity, and number three and four, bringing up the rear, organized pneumonia and acute eosinophilic pneumonia. When you see those patterns, you want to think about the possibility of vape, but you won't be able to say, yes, this person definitely has hypersensitivity and it can't be vape because of something on the CT.
All right. Well, given all of that, and you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but, you know, in these circumstances, then what should a radiologist anticipate will stick out to them first or jump out of the images first when they are presented with these patients that should kind of clue them in that this is the line of thinking that they should be following?
The classic case would be they'd see a young patient, and when we see younger patients for the most part, you're thinking they haven't been exposed to the world that much. They probably don't have underlying diseases or underlying issues. For the most part, there's a lot of obviously assumptions there. If you're working in a cancer hospital, you know, that's going to be a little different story. But usually younger patients, less chance for pre-existing pulmonary damage, less likely to have certain diseases may be associated with age. They come in, they have often a febrile illness, they get some chest imaging, and there's diffuse opacities that when you CT them may look like an acute lung injury pattern. So multifocal ground glass, little consolidation. Even better if that consolidation looks like it's beginning to organize somewhat. So a little bit of distortion, a little bit of beginning to dilate the bronchi as the consolidation wraps around the bronchus. When you see that, that suggests the possibility of vape. It is by no means the only thing that can do that exact pattern. You can see that various that pattern with COVID. You can see that pattern with other infections. You can see that type of pattern with various connective tissue disorders or interstitial pneumonia. But that's the kind of thing, that's the kind of high-risk situation that you would think about. You can add a little bit more fuel to the fire if you see subpleural sparing. So the stuff gets out near the pleural surface, and then it'll just more or less stop and just spare a little bit of lung between the periphery of the opacity and the actual chest wall. That, again, is not specific. That was first described or originally described in the context of trying to distinguish non-specific interstitial pneumonia from usual interstitial pneumonia, usually in older patients with fibrotic lung diseases. And then we've seen it in a number of other disorders as well. It's also not well standardized. How much is a pulse sparing? Is it, do you have to get within a centimeter of the chest wall? Is 2 centimeters good enough? How much is subpulse sparing versus actually just being a centrally predominant disease? We're tried to be fairly specific, but we couldn't come down to a definition that says, oh, well, you have to see it on, say, 10 slices or that sort of thing. So there's a lot of, I think, inter-observer variability for what really constitutes subpulse sparing. But nevertheless, it's something a radiologist can kind of latch onto with diffuse ground glass opacity, often with areas of organization, ideally in a younger patient. That would be the classic case. And like almost everything else in medicine, the classic case is probably the overall the least common. when you add up every other possible way you can come across this. So you'll see that in a fair number of patients, but it'll still be probably overall less than 50% of your patients, because at least for our population, I saw a fair number of patients that were well over 40. One of our older guys was a heart transplant patient, so clearly had some underlying cardiovascular issues. That always makes a diagnosis difficult. So we can't just say it's only going to be younger patients. You could have older patients with it. They're going to be complicated by having pre-existing respiratory diseases like, say, emphysema. They could have two things going on at once. They could have background of cardiovascular disease and that sort of stuff. So you have to keep the pattern in mind for everybody. But that would be your classic one, is that type of presentation in a younger patient. And often, if you look in their chart, if you're really lucky to really kind of put the cherry on top, you may see these patients represent. It is a very common thing that you'll see, oh, they were in an ER 2 weeks ago, and they were discharged without any imaging, complaining of respiratory complaints, maybe some nausea, vomiting, and fever. And they commonly will bounce back and forth like that before they finally get diagnosed. That's something we saw. That's something a lot of other people have reported as well. So that would help you to say, yeah, this is a recurrent exposure issue. That's why this person keeps coming back and forth.
All right. So then what's the next step then for the radiologist? If they see these images and they feel fairly confident that this is, you know, a EVALI injury, what's the next step? You know, what, I guess, is their role in advancing or changing the clinical process for the patient at this point?
Well, you mentioned it overtly in your report that the pattern you're seeing is, while nonspecific, is something that has been associated with a vape-associated pulmonary injury. And I probably, in that case, at least look in the electronic medical record. As this illness developed around the country, a lot of electronic medical records were modified to immediately show you whether or not there's a history of electronic device use. And so we use the Epic modality, or the Epic program at Mayo Clinic. And there is actually on the front page, when the radiologist pulls up a study, there's a lot of clinical information. That's one of the things that's up there now. So very quickly, a lot of institutions were recognizing that this is an issue and started providing the radiologists and other clinicians an immediate warning that, yes, there's been some history suggesting this patient does use these devices, or there is no such history. That's actually been very helpful, and that didn't exist before the EVALI epidemic was first reported or alerted to by the CDC. But what I would do is I'd probably end up calling, and I've done this a couple of times, I'd end up calling the clinicians and saying, you know, this looks a lot like it could be EVALI. It's probably worth some pointed questions. And they could either come back at that point and say, yeah, we went into that, and this guy denies using it. So they've gone as far as they can. They say, you know, we just kind of touched on it, but we're not totally sure. So we'll go back and investigate further. And that's where you can be really helpful, is you kind of circle people back to say, make sure you've really excluded this one. Because it kind of looks that way. And that's something that we see now and again. We even had one pulmonary physician looking for nicotine metabolites and a few other things in the urine, because he didn't necessarily believe a patient would be completely forthright with him when this patient kept bouncing back and forth with diffuse lung opacities in the manner I described. So it may send them back down the path of reinvestigation to either confirm the diagnosis or more convincingly say this is not the exposure that's causing this CT pattern.
All right. Well, Dr. Godway, I appreciate your taking the time this afternoon. Thank you so much.
Sure, no problem.
Thank you, Dr. Godway, for joining me. And thank you for listening to The Reading Room. And as always, visit www.diagnosticimaging.com for the latest in radiology news.